clearly started me thinking, but it started other people thinking as well. Word spread like wildfire around Tashkent that the British ambassador had been to a distant tribe, and people started coming to us for help. They started beating a path to our door. And we met victims of torture in person, the families of victims of torture, people with photographic evidence of torture. We had letters smuggled to us out of the gulags, and we started Human Rights Watch and others on the ground helping as well, and we built up a picture eventually that there were some 10,000 political prisoners in Uzbekistan, some 10,000, but that torture was happening on what you can only call an industrial scale, affecting thousands of people every year. One of the first bits of new evidence that came to me almost immediately after that trial was an envelope of photographs. They were photographs of a dead body. When I saw the photos, I'd never seen anything like this in my life. These injuries were beyond my experience. I couldn't understand them. So I sent them off to the pathology department at the University of Glasgow and asked if they could give me a report. The guy's corpse had been delivered back to his mother in a sealed casket, who had been ordered to bury the corpse the next day. She had disobeyed that. She'd got the body. She disobeyed an instruction not to open the casket. She got the body out onto the kitchen table because she had certain religious duties to perform by way of ensuring the body was washed before burial. When she saw the state of it, she took these photos and she got them to me in the embassy. The report came back from Glasgow and it said that the guy's, his name was Mr. Avazov, said his fingernails had been pulled out. He'd been beaten about the face and neck, and he died of immersion in boiling liquid. And it was immersion, not splashing, because there was a clear tie line around the upper torso and the upper limbs, and 100% scalding underneath. This was a regime that boiled people to death. I never came across one other example of someone actually being boiled to death, although the immersion of limbs into boiling liquid as a form of torture was quite normal, as was the use of rape, continually, use of electricity, pretty well everything you can think of a particular penchant for that practice the old man described of torturing people's children in front of them. We also found out what people were being forced to confess to. And they were being forced to confess regularly to membership of Al-Qaeda, or organizations linked to Al-Qaeda. They were often being forced to confess to going to Afghanistan, very often to confess to meeting Osama bin Laden in person, and they were having to sign up to long lists of people who were also members of Al-Qaeda. Usually, they had no idea who these people were or where they were. Very often, they weren't Uzbek names. They were just given a list and forced to sign up to it. Now, at the same time, as British ambassador under the UK-US Sharing Agreement, I was seeing the intelligence produced from Uzbekistan by the CIA. The CIA and MI6 share all intelligence, as do GCHQ and the NSA. I didn't actually have any intelligence to share. I don't want to spoil your enjoyment of James Bond films, but there was no MI6 station in Tashkent because it was too dangerous. MI6, in fact, do not serve in countries where you can't buy a cappuccino. But I was getting the CIA intelligence, and the CIA intelligence, which said on the face of it it came from the Uzbek security services, was naming many people as members of Al-Qaeda, long lists of names. It was talking of people travelling to Afghanistan and meeting Osama bin Laden in person, exactly the same stuff that was coming out of the torture chambers. I sent my deputy over to the American embassy to say my ambassador is worried this material may be coming from torture. She came back and said, yes, they say it probably is coming from torture. They don't see that as a problem in the context of a war on terror. Now, the interesting thing was that much of this information was so-called intelligence, was demonstrably untrue. There was, for example, intelligence about an Al-Qaeda training camp in the Tajik Hills above Samarkand, from where Al-Qaeda was supposed to be training a large force to swoop down and assault the city of Samarkand. My defense attaché had been there, and there was nothing there, physically, nothing at that location. My favorite example was in one of these lists of members of Al-Qaeda, which there's no democracy at all in Uzbekistan. There's no free media, no free speech. The opposition are not allowed to take part in elections. And there was one Uzbek dissident named as a member of Al-Qaeda, and that's who many of these people were, just Uzbek opposition figures. And I knew this guy, and he was a Jehovah's Witness. Now, you know, the CIA may think he was in Al-Qaeda, but I think there are not many Jehovah's Witnesses in Al-Qaeda. I don't imagine Al-Qaeda even tried to recruit Jehovah's Witnesses. I'm sure that wouldn't work the other way around. I'm sure Jehovah's Witnesses would try and recruit Al-Qaeda. They could be banging on the cave door of a watchtower saying, "You told me to come back next Saturday." But I found this information not credible. I told London this. We're now in October 2002. Navin, if you can think back that long ago, and I have to apologise for my naivety, but I want you to remember that this is before anyone outside the security services had heard the term extraordinary rendition. This is before we had the photographs of Abu Ghraib. This is before we knew what went on in Guantanamo Bay. And I thought, we're getting this intelligence from torture and the resulting information isn't true. Obviously, London don't know about this, and if I tell them, they will stop it. I actually believe that. I sent back a telegram to London detailing all I'd found, and I received a reply I will never forget. It said, "Dear Ambassador, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office is concerned you are perhaps over-focused on human rights." I remained over-focused and sent back more reports on what was going on. I was summoned back to a meeting in the Foreign Office, which happened on either the 7th or the 8th of March 2003. At that meeting, I was told three things, which I think are terribly important to know. The first, I was told by Sir Michael Wood, the Foreign Office's chief legal advisor, that it was not illegal for us to obtain intelligence through torture, provided that A, we did not do the torturing ourselves, and B, did not request that a specified individual be tortured. As long as we didn't do either of those things, if someone else tortured people and gave us the intelligence, that was fine. The second thing I was told was that Jack Straw had met Sir Richard Dearlove, the head of MI6, and they had decided, as a matter of policy, that in the war on terror, we would use intelligence and torture. And I was then told, of course, you are a civil servant, that's a ministerial policy, get back and do your job. But the third thing I was told is perhaps, in some ways, the most significant. And I'll very briefly expand on why it's significant. I was saying that this intelligence is not true. It vastly exaggerates the threat of Al-Qaeda in Central Asia. It's simply untrue material. And they had a gentleman there representing the intelligence services, his name was Matthew Kidd, and he was reading from a very carefully prepared written brief, and he was sticking very carefully to the words that had been down for him to say. And every time I said to him, "But it's not true," he would say, "It's operationally useful." I would say, "It's not true. This is rubbish. The information's crap." I should say crap, actually, which went down extremely strangely in Whitehall, I did. And he would come back and say, "It's operationally useful." And I want you to take that notion that intelligence nowadays, by MI6 and GCHQ and MI5, isn't judged by is it true or not, it's is it useful or not to what we want to do. And I want you to apply that concept to the intelligence on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. Was it useful? It was very useful if you wanted to start an illegal war. Was it true? No, it was a load of absolute rubbish, but the truth isn't what they were after. I used actually to head the FCO section dealing with Iraqi attempts at arms procurement at the time of the first Gulf Crisis. I did it for nearly 2 years. And I know what our capabilities were and what we knew. Believe you me, the Foreign Office has, and as do the MOD, you know, a huge number of very talented, very able people with an awful lot of resources. It is not the case that they were fooled about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. It's that a false intelligence picture was deliberately created, just as a false intelligence picture was deliberately being created out of Uzbekistan, exaggerating the strength of Al-Qaeda. Why would you want to do that? Well, I can quote from this excellent book, which I would recommend you to buy, because our kind hosts at WordPower need the money. You'll find in the front of it a facsimile of a letter to George Bush while he was still governor of Texas, stated April 3rd, 1997. It's from Enron, from Mr. Kenneth L. Lay, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Enron, and it suggests to the Honourable George W. Bush, Governor of the State of Texas. It starts, "Dear George," but they typed "Dear Governor Bush," and Ken Lay crossed it out and put "George." Now, I'll just read you a couple of sentences from it. "You will be meeting with Ambassador Sadiq Safayev, Uzbekistan's ambassador to the United States, on April the 8th. Enron has established an office in Tashkent, and we are negotiating a $2 billion joint venture with Neftigaz of Uzbekistan and Gazprom of Russia to develop Uzbekistan's natural gas." It finishes off, "I know you and Ambassador Safayev will have a productive meeting which will result in a friendship between Texas and Uzbekistan." The $2 billion was a foot in the door. It's not in their terms, it's actually a very small contract. That was a foot in the door to get into Central Asia's oil and gas. That was the actual motivation. In pursuit of those oil and gas contracts, the Americans were backing Karimov to the hilt. In 2002 alone, they gave $500 million, more than $500 million, in aid to the Karimov regime. And that's more than the United States gave to the whole of West Africa that year in aid. And this so-called aid, $120 million of it, was in equipment for the Uzbek armed forces, and $80 million of it was in assistance to the Uzbek security services, the people who were boiling people to death. How do you justify that much aid to what, by any standards, is one of the worst dictatorships on earth? You justify it by saying it's part of the war on terror and part of the fight against Al-Qaeda. Now, in fact, there is very, very little Islamic fundamentalism in Central Asia, particularly in Uzbekistan. If you were to have a referendum on the introduction of Sharia law, I don't reckon you would get... You would certainly get well less than 5% of the population would vote for the introduction of Sharia law. And if you explained it meant you couldn't drink vodka, less than 1% of the population would vote for the introduction. I have hundreds of Uzbek friends, I only know some of whom are imams, I only know one of them who doesn't drink vodka. The threat of Al-Qaeda in Central Asia was largely mythical. But what wasn't mythical was the US interest in geostrategic domination and acquiring the oil and gas. And that's what this was about. Also, of course, it fed in to the general drive to ramp up the perception of Al-Qaeda. We've all seen here in the UK a continual procession of terror alerts that turned out to be untrue, all of which were said at the time to be based on intelligence. We saw Forest Gate, we saw the famous ricin plot, where it turned out there was no ricin and no plot. But there have been a number of such things. My strong belief is actually it'll turn out there wasn't much truth. I'm not saying terrorism doesn't exist, it does exist, but I don't think there was a great deal of truth behind the greater than 9/11 mass murder on an unimaginable scale plot that was meant to terrify us this summer. And because they are not interested in whether the intelligence is true or not, they are interested in whether or not it does the job. And part of that job is to ramp up Islamophobia further by making us terrified that Muslims are all out to kill us, in order that we don't regard Muslims as quite human. And when those death tolls come in, and we see dead people in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, we hear of torture, we think they're not quite like us, so we don't quite care. And it prepares the ground for yet more and more attacks on Muslim countries, and for this continual drive to possess the world's hydrocarbon resources. An example I gave you of the little anecdotal evidence of what I personally witnessed and saw in Uzbekistan is in many ways an example of how real contracts like the Enron contract there, are actually behind the analysis which we heard and which was excellent, the academic analysis, but it's backed up. If you look at individual examples, and Uzbekistan is only one of them, you can actually see very clearly what is happening in the world today. And I certainly hope that what I've been able to tell you this evening and what you can read in the book I've published will let a little chink of light into that rather secret governmental world. Thank you.